We have many things we want to discuss. So let us begin. Let us begin and see where we are. Okay, so this is just to give you a little bit of a Google Maps, right? First of all, we are on our road that we have mentioned many times before, the Path of the Patriarchs. Hey, perhaps not the original exactly, right? Route 60 is not 100% the Path of the Patriarchs because of politics, because of topography. It's been moved in various places, but it more or less follows that route through the mountains. If we were to continue it south, we would get to Beit El, to Jerusalem, to Bethlehem, to Hebron, ultimately to Beersheba. Okay, but we are going to be following it north. So just to see where we're going, right? This is our Route 60 here. Okay. Route 60, like I said, more or less following. Now, really, in ancient times, the path of the patriarchs is Derech Avot, would continue straight to Nablus, or as we call it in Hebrew, Shechem, right? And at that point, you have the valley, you have big mountains afterwards, and the road kind of split in different directions. Today, because Shechem is under the auspices of the Palestinian Authority, so the Israeli roads are not going there, and the road splits already earlier, right? Going up in the direction of Mount Gerizim. Going to the west or going to the east towards Elon Moreh. We're going to talk about both those places. But what do I want you to notice here? I want you to notice where Shiloh is. Okay, here is Shiloh. I want you to notice where Har Bracha is, right? Har Bracha is Mount Gerizim, is the Jewish community on Mount Gerizim. Elon Moreh also. Kidumim and Sebastia, not too far away, right? So we want to understand all of those various places, and to understand that this is the area that is called Shomron in Hebrew, Samaria in English. Where does that name come from? We are going to get to it. I also want you to pay attention to Shechem, to Nablus, okay? Which, even though today it is a large Palestinian city, which Jews have very little access to, right? Occasional access to the tomb of Joseph in Shechem. Obviously, IDF soldiers go into Shechem, but in general, it's pretty off limits to Jews, to Israelis, certainly. But it is a very, very significant site, and it really is the center of the country. It's one of the things we tend to forget when we think about geography in terms of politics, right? Because we think about places where we go, places where we don't go, places that are comfortable, places that are more Jewish, more Palestinian. But if you just looked at the map straight on without any political considerations, Shechem is the center of the country. Okay? It's about an hour, a little more from Jerusalem. Okay? It's about a half hour to the east to the Jordan Valley. It's about another half hour to the west towards the coast. It's really in the middle, very centrally located in a valley, very fertile, really very logical choice for a capital. So good to keep that in mind as we go on. Okay, so that's just to get a sense of our location and where we are. And we're going to start with the mountains of Gerizim and Eival. Okay, Gerizim and Eival, where we're coming up on those summer Torah portions in the book of Deuteronomy and the book of Devarim, where Moses is basically giving over his last will and testament, what's going to happen when they come into the land. And one of the things he says is when you come into the land, one of the things you need to do, and there's an extensive discussion in the Gemara about is it supposed to be the day they come in or doesn't have to be till much later? We're not going to go into that, but it's fascinating. But when you come into the land, you need to have this kind of a public spectacle, right? A public covenant making at these mountains, Gerizim and Eval, in the center of the country. Gerizim and Eval are the two mountains on either side of Shechem. Shechem literally means shoulders. These are the two shoulders above Shechem. And you are going to come and you are going to give the blessings on Mount Gerizim, the curses on Mount Eval. Also have to build an altar on Mount Eval. We'll come to that in a moment. But this is a very significant moment once the children of Israel have crossed into the land, right? Perhaps before they begin the conquest, perhaps after. Again, like I said, the timing is not 100% clear. But at some point, they have to have this covenantal meeting in the center of the country by these two mountains, right? So the picture that you're looking at here is actually not a picture of Mount Grisim or of Mount Deval. Okay? I want you to picture a triangle. Okay? There are three mountains. In fact, can we see this nicely over here? More or less, not perfectly. Okay? We can't have everything. Oh, one more thing that I didn't point out here, so it's good that we have it back. It is, sorry, let's just move this up for a moment. Okay, is Sebastia. We're going to talk about that. Sebastia, ancient Shomron. But the other thing I wanted you to notice here is a kind of a triangle. Okay, you have Mount Gerizim, which is really on our map here, Har Bracha. Okay, you have Mount Eval, which is not actually written on our map. And then we have another mountain, which is where the community of Elon Moreh is built, and that's called Mount Kabir, Har Kabir. Kabir meaning from the Aramaic and then the Arabic word great, large, enormous, and it is enormous, but the other two mountains are pretty big too. Okay, and I want you to notice this triangle, right? This nice triangle. So the mountain we're looking at is Har Kabir. That's what's in the picture, where you have an amazing view from there to Mount Gerizim and Mount Ebal and Shechem in the middle and the valley below. And when you come to Israel, it's an amazing place to go because you really get a sense of how this whole story played out. And we're going to read a very interesting eyewitness account from 19th century in a minute. The other thing I want you to notice in this beautiful picture is the valley below. Okay. When you stand on Har Kabir, you have this gorgeous 360 view in all directions out to the Jordan Valley and to Shechem and all over. But you also have a view to the north of the mountain. And this is a valley called the Tirtza Valley, Nachal Tirtza. Okay? Remember that we are in the tribe. Shechem is on the edge between Ephraim and Manasseh, right? And if you remember the daughters of Slofchad, right? Remember the daughters of Slofchad? They are in this week's Parsha, okay? Who want the land, who want a portion in the land. And one of them is named Tirtza, right? And they come from the tribe of Manasseh. And here's this valley that is named, this riverbed that's named after Tirtza. Right. And one of the suggestions is that they really did do the blessings and the curses on the day they crossed the Jordan into the land. And one group goes from the Jordan River through Nachal Tirtza all the way to Shechem. Okay? And this is, there are many, many biblical stories that are connected here. The story of Joseph, the story of Avimelech, the king who kills all his brothers. We're not going to go into all of them, but there's a lot of Bible here. Okay. Now, when you take a satellite picture, which is what this is, and I apologize, it is somewhat blurry, and you can look at it on Google Satellite yourself and probably get a better picture. But when you take a satellite picture of Gerizim and Eval, you notice something very interesting that was already noticed over 150 years ago. Okay. I'm in 1879. I'm going to read you the 140 years ago. I'm going to read you the description in a minute. But what you notice is that on the side of Mount Ebal and on the side of Mount Gerizim are kind of indentations, creating almost a natural amphitheater. Now, the way the story is depicted, both in the Book of Devarim and in Yoshua and Joshua, is that you have some of the Kohanim, some of the Levim, really, on one side of the mountain, right on one mountain. And you have one group on the other mountain, and the people seem to be in the middle. And the question is, how could they possibly have heard anything? But when you look at the satellite picture, or if you happen to have been here long before the huge urban development and urban sprawl of Shechem, you notice that this is really naturally built for acoustics. And so I'm going to read you this short little passage. It's just great, right? In 1879, somebody named J.W. McGarvey made a tour of the Holy Land, and he came to Shechem, and he decided to test out the story of the blessings and the curses. So here's what he said. Now he's a good Christian man. He knows his Bible, right? Our route took us back through the valley, and we resolved that while passing between the two mountains of Eval and Gerizim in the still morning air, we would try the experiment of reading the blessings and the curses. Right? And he goes through how they read it and how could they possibly have heard it? Would it work? Right? But it is interesting to know that the spot chosen by God for this reading is a vast natural amphitheater in which the human voice can be heard to a surprising distance. About halfway between Shechem and the mouth of the valley in which it stands, there is a deep semicircular recess in the face of Mount Eval, and a corresponding one precisely opposite to it in Mount Gerizim. Today, you can't see this, and I doubt it would work today because it's so built up. But in 1879, it wasn't built up. No man with his eyes open can ride along the valley without being struck with the singular formation. As soon as I saw it, I recognized it as the place of Joshua's reading. Okay, so what does he do? He's a curious guy. He tries a scientific experiment. I took a position, Bible in hand, in the middle of the valley. Brother Taylor and Frank, to represent six tribes, climbed halfway up the slope of Mount Gerizim. Brother Earl, to represent the other six tribes, took a similar position on Mount Ebal. I read, right, he's in the middle. They were to pronounce Amen after each curse or blessing. Brother Taylor heard me distinctly, and I could hear his response. Brother Earl could not distinguish the words because there were some terraces between me and him. But the experiment made it perfectly obvious that if Joshua had a strong voice, he could have been heard by an audience without the assistance of the Levites, right? So it's just a great example. First of all, how you can bring the story to life, and also how people who were traveling in those days, right, good Christians, good Jews, really did want to see if this could work, right? So you have our natural amphitheater here in Gerizim and Ebal. Now that's the topography, right? And when you go up on Mount Kabir and you look, it's very easy to picture the scene, to understand it, with Shechem in the valley in the middle, the mountains on either side to the south and to the north. But we have another story that talks about Mount Ebal, right? And this is the story of the altar on Mount Ebal, okay? We have a story of an altar on Mount Ebal that was discovered by a fascinating archaeologist named Adam Zertal. We're going to talk about him in a second, okay? And he, now after the Six-Day War, there were a lot of places that needed to be rediscovered. The Jewish quarter in the old city in Jerusalem, the Golan, and the areas of Judea and Samaria, which had been in Jordanian hands. And there was no possibility from 48 to 67 for Israelis to do archaeological excavations. So after the Six-Day War, they did a survey of Samaria. And the person who did the survey, I'll just show you his picture for a moment, is Adam Zertal, a really incredible archaeologist, incredible human being, who died 6 years ago. As you can see, he was not a well man. He was wounded in the Yom Kippur War. And he was on crutches basically after that for the rest of his life. But he decided when he was in the hospital, when he was recovering, that his life was going to be archaeology. And he never let his physical disability stand in his way. And he walked more kilometers than most people that are listening to this lecture, certainly more than I ever did. And what was the survey of Samaria? The survey was exactly that, literally walking through the land, and he would take groups of students and they would, fan out over a location, and they would just walk across it to see if anything odd in the landscape, what's going on, should we dig here, right? It wasn't excavations. It was an attempt to see where to excavate. And in 1980, they decided that they had found a spot on Mount Ebal. Mount Ebal is a vast, enormous mountain. Much of it is an army base today. You need special permission to have access to it, but they found a place that they realized needed to be excavated, and they started, whoever's not on mute, please mute yourself, or maybe orally mute everybody, and they started to excavate in 1980, and they found this strange structure. And they found this strange structure, which you're seeing part of it in the picture, which has ramps, which has corners. And he wasn't quite sure what it was. And he comes, and they happen to be staying in one of the religious communities in the Shomron. And at dinner, sitting around, and he kind of sketches a picture of what it is. It wasn't as sophisticated a picture as this, because they hadn't found everything yet. But basically, it was a picture of this rectangle with corners, with a ramp, and they're in a religious community. And one of the guys sitting at the table with them, he sees this drawing and he gets really excited and he jumps up and he runs out of the room and he comes back 10 minutes later and he's holding a Mishnah. Okay. He's holding a Mishnah that has diagrams in it, and it has a diagram of the altar from the temple. And he says, I think you found an altar. It's not exactly like the temple altar. Okay. There are pieces pieces that don't fit so well. It's rectangular, it's not square, it doesn't have everything that we would want it to have, but it's a lot of similarities to the altar that we know that they had in First Temple times and in Second Temple times. And as they continued to excavate, they found, first of all, tons of kosher bones, okay, buried nearby, okay? And also, perhaps more significantly, they found something that could date this structure. It's a structure that wasn't used for a very long time, and they found scarabs, right? Egyptian scarabs from the period of Ramses II, meaning we're talking about the time period of the Exodus, which is when this altar is built. Moses says to Joshua, when you come into the land, build this altar on Mount Ebal, and it seems that that's when this is from. Not everybody agrees with Zertal's analysis, but some scholars do. And if it's true, and this is really Joshua's altar, it's an amazing discovery. Now, Zertal was very interesting because he was not a religious man in any way, but he is very much relied on the Bible as a source. And he loved this idea that you put the altar on Mount Ebal, right? We're going to see the Samaritans are very into Mount Gerizim. Mount Gerizim is the mountain of blessing. Mount Ebal is the mountain of curses. He says, no, in Judaism, there's no such thing as somebody, as a mountain or an individual who is cursed or blessed. Everybody has free will, even mountains, right? No, mountains don't have free will, but it's meant to show you that idea that even the cursed mountain could be the mountain that's chosen to have God's altar on it. And that's how he looked at it. And he wrote a wonderful book about it called Am Nolad, A People Is Born. And he saw this covenantal experience as very, very significant. So there's a whole more story to that, but we will not be going into it right now because we are just doing a survey. Hey, now, one of the significant sites, we're going to get to Shechem. We're going to talk about Shechem in a moment. One of the very significant sites in Shechem, which was the subject of much controversy and tragedy as well in the last 25 years, is Joseph's tomb. And if you remember the biblical story, right, first of all, Joseph has a deep connection to Shechem. Okay, when he sent in the book of Genesis, right, Jacob sends him, check up on your brothers, see what's happening. He goes to Dothan, which is right north of Shechem, and that's where they throw him in the pit and they sell him to the slave traders and he gets sent to Egypt, right? So not a particularly happy story. Years later, when he's already, you know, in charge, second in command in Egypt, and Jacob comes down to Egypt, Jacob says to him, I'm going to give you the city of Shechem. Shechem is a city of trouble and divisions. It's also a city of holiness. It's a city that Jacob's sons get embroiled in a very serious conflict, right? And Jacob decides he is going to give the city of Shechem to Joseph as an inheritance. Now, Joseph himself is not a tribe. He has two sons. They are two tribes, Ephraim and Manasseh, and Shechem is in between both of them. And he says when he dies, right, he knows that his brothers and his children are not going to be able to take him to be buried in the land of Israel like he took his father. So he says, when you are redeemed from Egypt, take my bones with you. And it's a powerful promise that one day they're going to return to the land. And lo and behold, in the book of Exodus, in Sefer Shemot, what's the thing that everybody's getting ready to leave Egypt? What is Moses busy doing? Getting Joseph's bones. And he brings them to the land and they are buried in Shechem. So you have this tomb, which is a very significant in its, you know, the emotional resonance of it's the meaning of that. It's the promise that we're going to get out of Egypt. And he's buried there. And it is one of these biblical era tombs that basically we are pretty sure that it's the right one. There aren't so many, but this is one of them. And this is how it looked long ago. Today, it is in the heart of downtown Shechem. And let's just find it and circle it because I always have trouble finding these things. And even in my nice picture here, okay, here we go. It's even worse when you're standing up on a mountain and you're looking for it, right? Here's our Joseph's tomb, okay, in the center of Shechem. And you may recall that at the very beginning of the Second Intifada in September of 2000, there was a terrible attack in Joseph's tomb. A Druze soldier was wounded and basically bled to death there. It was another terrible story of somebody from a nearby community who came and was murdered on his way to Joseph's tomb. And today, the army allows access, but only about once a month, usually in the middle of the night. It's not an easy place to get to. But it is a site that people still want to come back to and still want to visit because it really is an important and an authentic site. Let's continue to, now this is a good way for us to understand this story of Shechem. We said it's a city of divisions. Okay, so let's first understand where it is in the land in terms of the tribes. Okay, so here we are. Right in this map, it's put in Menasheh, but really it's more like on the border between Menasheh and Ephraim. It really belongs to the two brothers. Hey, and like I said, we have all these significant stories here: the story of Shimon and Levi and the rape of Dinah, the story of Joseph, right, the story of Abimelech. But perhaps the most significant division story, right, we have good stories as well. We have the story of the covenant, but the most significant division story is after the death of King Solomon. Right? We've had two generations, David and Solomon, of a united kingdom of all of the tribes together. And then along comes Solomon's son, Rehoboam, takes the advice of his younger courtiers as opposed to the elder statesmen. The younger courtiers say to him, raise the taxes, be tougher than your father was. And this is kind of the last straw for many of the tribes who have been, you know, given a lot of money for Solomon's building projects. They want a little break from taxes. And there's an upstart from the tribe of Ephraim, whose name is Jeroboam, and he decides that he is going to create his own kingdom. And this is when we have the breakaway kingdom of Israel as opposed to the kingdom of Judah. And what does he choose? Where does he make his capital? In Shechem. Okay, this is where he gathers all the people. This is where they decide that they are rejecting the Davidic line. This is where they start their new kingdom. He makes temples in Beit El and in Dan, but he makes his capital in Shechem, right? And perhaps the idea is we are going back to a pre-Davidic time, to a time when Jerusalem is not important, going back to the time of Joshua. There's a lot of suggestions, but the very practical one is what I said. Shechem is in the center of the country, and it's a powerful city. And from this point on, right, until the exile of the kingdom of Israel in 722, This is a division. They're not reunited again. Sometimes they are more peaceful and more amicable towards each other, sometimes less, but the two kingdoms do not reunite. So Shechem is very symbolic of this division. Okay, so let's take a look a little more deeply at Shechem and understand what we are talking about. Sorry, just want to make sure that my watch is good. So like we said, Shechem is between the mountains, shoulders, right? So Shechem is the city, used to be just the city down in the valley. In the last 30, 40 years, it has expanded greatly, going up the slope of Mount Gerizim, growing all the way deep into the valley between the two mountains, much, much, much bigger than it was before. But just so you get a sense of what we've been talking about, the mountain here on the left in the south is Mount Gerizim. The larger mountain on the right, the very large mountain with the antenna on the top, and it looks more bald, right? Some people say that's because it's the mountain of curses. That's Mount Ebal, okay? And the Shechem is the valley in the middle. The most ancient part of Shechem, the Tel of Shechem, is actually in the refugee camp today that's in the middle of the city, Tel Balata, and that's right where the tomb of Joseph is. There were excavations that were done here in the early part of the 20th century. There were excavations that were done again when this was in the hands of Jordan. First Germans excavated, then Americans excavated. Since then, it has not been excavated, but when they did excavate here in the 20s and then later in the 50s and 60s, they found a city that goes back to early Bronze Age, meaning it's more than 4,000 years old. Okay, the most significant part, the most significant period in the city is a Middle Bronze, right? There's a temple. It's a very important city. We're talking about 18th to 15th century before the Common Era. There's a wall, there's a gate. And what's very interesting is there's a destruction period about the 12th century, which is around the time of Joshua, right? Leading us to believe there's some kind of a conquest. And a rebuilding around 975, which is our time period of this divided kingdom. So we have evidence, sparse as it is, it would be wonderful to be able to do more excavations, but some evidence of the stories that we have of the conquest and of the rebuilding of the city as Yerevan's capital. Now, later on, in Second Temple and later times, in Roman times, the city becomes a Roman city and it gets a new name. It gets a Roman name. If you ever wondered why is Shechem, Nablus, what are the connections between those two names? It's actually a corruption of the Roman name of the city. The Roman name of the city was Neapolis, the new city, Nea. Polis. Arabs have trouble pronouncing the letter P. So Neapolis, which you kind of can say quickly and slur it together, became Nablus, right? But it's the same city. It's founded basically on the northern slope of Mount Gerizim. It's founded right after the destruction of the Second Temple in 72 CE. There was a massive temple built at the top. And if you see these coins, right, this is a great coin from Neapolis, from Nablus, right? So you can see that depicted on the coin is this large temple. It's on the top of the hill called Tel Aras. It seems it was a 1500 step staircase leading up to it. Today, you can go, if you go to Har Bracha, to the Samaritan area on Mount Gerizim, the temple is no longer there, but you can go to the lookout point from which you can look down into Shechem. It's an amazing, amazing view. And this is where the focal point, you know, everybody, the city was down in the valley, but you would look up and you would see the temple. And this is a classic Roman design to have that temple on top of the Acropolis. Today, Shechem is a huge urban sprawl. Just to give you a sense of numbers, 1961, there were about 46,000 people living in Shechem. In 2014, there were about 146,000 people living in Shechem. So it has grown enormously and not a particularly friendly city to Israelis, although there are places that are definitely worse. And it's somewhat of a prosperous city. It's a city that has really grown a lot. When we get to the Samaritans, we'll talk about the Samaritans in a few minutes. The Samaritans used to live in Shechem, but then things started to feel somewhat uncomfortable for them, they moved out in the first Intifada in the 1980s. We will come back to the Samaritans. Let's talk for a minute about Shomron. Right, so we've been saying Shomron, using it as the name of the region, but really, it didn't start out as the name of the region. It started out as the name of a city. And really, it didn't start out as the name of a city. It started out as the name of a person. Right? There was a fellow named Shemer, and Shemer owned some land. Right? And along comes the king of Israel, one of the very powerful kings of Israel, Omri. Omri's son is Ahav of Elijah fame, right? But Omri is the father. He's the founder of the dynasty. And he decides that Shechem is very nice. Tirzah, another city, is very nice. But he wants to create his own new capital. So he buys a piece of land from this fellow, Shemer, and he decides to build a capital. And it's interesting because he chooses to build something from scratch. He doesn't choose a site that has ritual significance or any other kind of holiness to it. He wants to build a secular capital, a city that he builds from the ground up. Okay. And the city has been excavated. Okay? We're going to see it has a different name, Sebastia, but that's because of its later history. Okay? But biblically, it's called Shomron. And we have found walls of the palace of Omri's son, Ahav, hey, walls of the palace. And not only that, really one of the most exciting things that was found here, because it fits so beautifully with the words of the prophets. If you look at the bottom here, right, these are all in Harvard University, hey, from the excavations that were done here. These are carved pieces of ivory. Okay, carved pieces of ivory, very intricate, very beautiful. Why is carved ivory a big deal? Well, ivory comes from elephants. We don't have any elephants in the land of Israel. So the raw material had to be imported. and it was presumably rather expensive, just like it is today. And then it had to be decorated and carved. So we are talking about a real luxury item. That's what this is. Right? Now, why is this so exciting? Because the prophet Amos, right? Prophet Amos, who lives in the mid-8th century BCE, he lives in the time of very powerful and very economically successful kings, Jeroboam II, Uzziah, and Judah. And a lot of his prophecy is about social justice. And he says, you wealthy guys in Samaria, you sleep on beds of ivory, mitot shen. It doesn't mean a bed made out of ivory. That would really be impossible to do. It means these beautiful decorations on the headboards. And here we're finding it, right? We're finding these decorated pieces of ivory. He wasn't exaggerating. They really were that wealthy. Now, what happens to Shomron is that in Second Temple times, along comes Herod, right? Herod, who changes and fixes and improves everything in the land of Israel. And he decides that this needs to be a Roman city. And as is Herod's custom, he decides to name it for various patrons. He always names things for patrons, right? We've got Caesarea. We've got so many different places. He calls the city Sebastia because he names it in honor of the Emperor Augustus or the Emperor Octavian. Sebastia is Augustus in Greek, okay? And he puts in a theater and a temple and a forum and a cardo, right? All these nice classic pieces of Roman architecture, and that's what he adds in. Now, the other picture is not a picture of Herod, right? It's a fabulous picture. I love this picture. It's a fabulous picture of Hanan Porat, who was one of the leaders of Gush Emunim, of the post-Six-Day War, post-Yom Kippur War, really, settlement movement, movement to establish Jewish communities in the places that were reclaimed in the Six-Day War. And one of the focal points of this resettlement was in Sebastia. Okay, in 1974, Gush Emunim, this organization, tries to settle by the Sebastia train station. And it's just this struggle back and forth between them and the army. They're removed and they come back 7 times. The army obviously is removing them because the government is not allowing them to settle there. 7 times they're removed, 7 times they return, until finally the government allows 25 families to settle in a nearby army base called Kadum, which eventually is called Kidumim, right? It becomes a community called Kidumim. But this is Hanan Porat when he hears the news that they are actually allowed to settle. This is the winter of 1975, and then they've gotten permission to establish the community of Elon Moreh, and it's just an ecstatic picture. Whether you agree with the politics or not, it's an amazing picture. So that's Sebastia. We're going to spend a few minutes talking about Shiloh, and then I want to spend some time on the Samaritans because they really are very important and very interesting. So Shiloh, if you remember, that was on the bottom of our map. That was in the south, right? Closer to Beit El, about a half hour south of Shechem, maybe a little bit less, depends on traffic, right? Now, Shiloh is the place, if Shechem is the place where we have the covenant, and Shechem is the place of the capital, Shiloh is the place where the tabernacle, where the Mishkan is brought. Okay? They come into the land, 14 years of conquest and settlement, and then Joshua says, set the tabernacle, set the Mishkan up in Shiloh. And according to the rabbis, it stays there for almost 4 centuries, right? Shiloh is a spiritual home for the Jewish people for a very long time. Now, ultimately, Shiloh is destroyed, the tabernacle is moved, and ultimately, the temple is built in Jerusalem. But Shiloh is a significant site. Now, do we know where Shiloh is? We have a pretty good idea because we have a description in the book of Judges that tells us exactly where it is. It's on the main road going north from Beit El, right, on the way near Ma'ale Levonai. It's really actually a very, very accurate description. And there were excavations that were done there, and there were all kinds of amazing antiquities there. But the best thing is always to find the welcome to Shiloh sign. And that was discovered in excavations that were done relatively recently in one of the churches on the site, because Shiloh is also important to Christians. And this is a very early church. It's a Byzantine church, 4th century. And the Greek says, God bless the people of Selun. Selun is Greek for Shiloh. So Shiloh really is Tel Shiloh that we know today, really is Shiloh of the Bible, really is Shiloh of Byzantine times. There have been many excavations that have been done there over the last 100 years or so. And among the things that have been discovered is the Canaanite city that was built here before the Israelites came, right? And we have a ritual site that was built by the Canaanites. It's unclear if it was just a ritual site. Houses have not been found from Canaanite times, but we have found this large, impressive wall, okay, from before the Israelite period. And then, and this is what you can see in the picture, here's the wall in the back. And here, where this guy is standing in the forefront, there are these storerooms. Why would you have storerooms outside the city, outside the wall? Because when the Israelites come, they actually expand the city. And the Canaanite wall is not the wall of the city anymore, right? The city grows, the city expands. Now, we know that the Mishkan, that the tabernacle, is in Shiloh for centuries. But the question is, did people go to it? Did people use it? And that's that directional verse that I said to you from the very end of the book of Judges, right? We have this this suggestion that they should go to this festival in Shiloh. You know, Shiloh, it's on the road coming from Beit El. And you have to say to yourself, if everybody went to Shiloh three times a year on the holidays, why do they need directions how to get there? And it seems that it was neglected. And in the very book of the beginning of Samuel, right? Very important story where this guy named Elkanah, who has two wives, comes to Shiloh, right? One wife, Penina, has children. Hannah doesn't have children. This is where we get the beginnings of, by the way, of silent prayer, of private prayer. It comes from Hannah, who would go and who went to pray in the tabernacle asking for a child. But the rabbis pick up on this idea that people did not go as often as they should to the Mishkan. And they said, Elkanah was one of the people who kind of revived this pilgrimage to the tabernacle. And every year he would go and he would gather people and they would go together until people started to come back. But powerful eyewitness to the fact that people didn't go. When I say they didn't go, what does that mean? They didn't worship? No, of course they worship, but they worship closer to home. And on the very next hill over from Shiloh, right, is a place called Givat Harel. They found this, which, as you can see, has these nice corners. This is an altar. It's an altar, literally a 10-minute walk from Shiloh, right? People liked their local ritual sites. They may have gone to the tabernacle, but they also wanted something local. And it seems that even though it was such an important place and it was there for so long, that it was somewhat neglected. Now, the million-dollar question in Shiloh, you have this big, beautiful tell, big site, a lot of excavations, much more to be excavated. The main question is, well, where was the Mishkan, right? It's very nice to find the walls, the storeroom, the houses, the cisterns, but really what we want to find is the remains of this site, and can we find them? So there have been various suggestions. One suggestion, there is a large, today it's a mosque, we think originally it was a synagogue, right outside of the tell, right? It's called Jama Asiton. Maybe this was where the Mishkan was. Archaeologists suggest that. It seems far away. It's far away from the entrance to the city. Another suggestion, which seems, you know, to fit very well with antiquity, is, well, maybe it was on the Acropolis, on the top of the site, which today has a whole audiovisual and a movie and everything else, right? But maybe it was on the top of the site. No evidence to prove that, right? Lots of different suggestions. The most likely suggestion is that it was to the north of the site, because when you come into the city, you walk, you go up to the top, to the Acropolis, you come down the other side, and you see this kind of a strange thing. There's a long bedrock wall, right? A long natural wall, okay? And right across from it, you have a second parallel bedrock wall, okay? Now, between the two walls is 25 meters, okay? 25 meters translates biblically into 50 amot, 50 cubits, which is exactly the width of the courtyard of the tabernacle, as you can see in the book of Exodus over here. So you have these bedrock walls, you have the correct width, right? And you have this fascinating Mishnah in the Gemara in Zbachim, right? Where it says that the tabernacle had no roof, but had a base of stones with a ceiling of curtains. Because it was there for so long, it was kind of semi-permanent. The bottom was bedrock, The top was curtains, not like in the desert where they moved, you know, all the time and everything was portable. But here it was semi-permanent. So the suggestion is these walls that are here, the distance fits. Besides that, it fits perfectly with the story where the messenger comes to tell the high priest Eli that the Ark of the Covenant has been captured and the Israelites have been defeated. It talks about how he comes into the city. And Eli hears people crying. He doesn't know what's going on. And only then does the messenger come to him, which seems to indicate that the Mishkan is on the outskirts of the city. It's at the edge of the city. He has to pass through the whole city in order to get there. So all of these suggestions, all of these pieces of evidence make Rav Yoel ben Nun, as well as others, suggest that the Mishkan in Shiloh is to the north of the Tel, on the very edge of the city, of the biblical city. All right, we also have a hill above where they found all sorts of pieces of pottery, which seems to indicate that that's where they would eat their sacrifices because you had a view of the Tell. So we don't know 100%. There are some problems with this theory. Excavations that were done here did not find animal bones, which you would find in a place that had sacrifices for centuries upon centuries. But at the moment, it's the most likely possibility. Okay, we're going to spend the rest of our time talking about the Samaritans, who are supremely important in this area, not because of their numbers, there are very few of them, but because they are a remnant of a very ancient past, and they are a fascinating contrast to Jews of today, or Jews even of a few thousand years ago. So first of all, just to understand, when we talk about Samaritans, right, and that's why I brought this sign, just because it's funny, right? If you come certainly from North America or from Europe and you say the word Samaritans, usually it's preceded by the adjective good, right? Good Samaritans. There's even a good Samaritan law in America, right? So good Samaritans are people who are always going to help you out. And that's what the sign is saying. Whatever you've done, whatever life's done to you, we're here for you anytime, right? Now, where does this come from? This comes from a story in the New Testament, right? Where Jesus tells a parable, right? It's not actually a real story. It's a parable, but there is a site that is related to this, where he talks about a man walking along this very treacherous road from Jericho to Jerusalem, and he's set upon by bandits, and he's attacked, and he's left on the side of the road, and he's bleeding. And along comes a priest, a Kohen, on his way to the temple. And the man says, please help me. And he says, no, what if you die on me? I'll be impure. I can't help you. I'm sorry. Along comes a Levite, the same story. And then along comes a Samaritan. And the Samaritan, in the time of Second Temple, the lowest of the low, right? Really a very low social class. He's the guy who puts his neck out and he goes and he helps him. And he, and it's not a particularly friendly to Jews story, right? But who are these guys? That's where the term Good Samaritan comes from. And it's very much a Christian term. But who are they? And what's their story? And why are they on Mount Gerizim? So let's try and understand that. So there are two versions of the story. One version is the Jewish version, and one version is the Samaritan version. Okay? The Jewish version of the story is that when the Assyrians come in 722, and they conquer, they finish their conquest of the Northern Kingdom, and they exile the 10 tribes and send them to Assyria. What did the Assyrians do? What was their modus operandi in conquering? They would do a transfer of populations. They didn't want to destroy the land. They wanted the land to still be able to, you know, be productive, and they needed people to work the land, but they didn't want the locals to work the land because the locals are going to rebel. So what would they do? They would take one group of people that they had conquered, move them somewhere far, far away where they have no connections and no interest, and take that group of people and move them to the other place, right? Transfer of populations. And the Bible tells us that that's what they do. And they bring in all these various tribes, one of whom is from a place called Kuta. And that's why the rabbis later called the Samaritans the Kutim. Samaritans, Shomronim, Kutim, it's all the same thing. But what happens? They come into the land of Samaria and they don't know how to worship God. And God is angry with them. So he sends lions. And that's where you have this lovely graphic picture, right? Lions who come to eat them because they are not worshiping God properly, right? And so they go to the Assyrians and they say, listen, we don't want to be eaten by lions. You need to send us somebody from the original guys who were here to teach us how to behave properly so that we don't get eaten by lions anymore, right? And they bring some back, a Levite, and he teaches them what to do. And they become known in rabbinical literature as Gerei Arayot, the lion converts, meaning they're not originally Jewish. They don't convert completely to Judaism. But they settle into the land and they start to keep some of the laws. And when the Jews return in the Persian period, in the return to Zion, Shivat Zion, and they go to Jerusalem and they start to build a temple, we have another very formative story, right? Where in the book of Nehemiah, the Samaritans come to the Jews and they say, we want to build a temple with you. And the Jews say, no, you're not the real thing. And Nehemiah says to them, Lo lanu vilachem livnot beit Hashem. We're not building with you. And at that point, there's this split, there's this break between them. And throughout Second Temple times and later, the Samaritans are seen by the rabbis as quasi-Jews, and quasi-Jews who cause a lot of trouble, right? So the picture that you're looking at here is a picture of a mountain in the Jordan Valley called the Sartaba, right? And this is one of the mountains that they would light signal fires on to tell the people when it was the new month, right? You'd have to have eyewitnesses come to the temple, proclaim the new month, and then they would light these signal fires from mountain to mountain so people would know. But the rabbis saw that the Samaritans, the Kutim, wrecked this system. They would light fake fires on the wrong days because they were antagonists to the rabbis. And so instead of doing that, they had to send out messengers, right? And messengers took much longer. And that's why the time period, the days of the holidays in the diaspora were never as clear as they were in the land of Israel. And that's why they keep 2 days of Yom Tov in the diaspora. So if you don't like keeping 2 days of Yom Tov, go blame the Kutim, blame the Samaritans. Now, the Samaritans tell a completely different story. Okay? They see themselves as the true Jews. They see themselves as the descendants of the tribes of Levi, of Ephraim and Menashe. Okay? They believe they are part of, the Levites are broken chain of high priests that goes all the way back to Aaron. And that's this picture here on the left. If you go to the Samaritan Museum, they will show you generation after generation after generation of high priests. They believe that the tabernacle was originally in Shechem and was moved wrongfully to Shiloh. And that was kind of the original sin of the Israelites. And they stay behind and remain true to the real place, which we're going to see in a minute, is Mount Gerizim, right? And they never leave. And they have many things that go very, very far back. So for example, their Torah, as you can see here, one of the old Torahs, is written in the old Hebrew script, not exactly the old Hebrew script that we find in archaeology, but very, very similar. Okay. They believe that the holy place is not Mount Moriah in Jerusalem, but is Mount Gerizim. And in fact, this is clearly, the rabbis write about this, right? We have a minor tractate called the Tractate of the Kutim. And it talks about how the Samaritans keep many of the laws like the Jews do, but they cannot be accepted as Jews until they reject Mount Gerizim as the holy place and they return to believing in the temple in Jerusalem. Okay, so this is a very significant part of their belief. They lived in Shechem up until relatively recently. There was a group of them that was brought to the Israeli city of Holon in 1950 by then President Yitzhak Ben Zvi. He became president a little later. Today, the community is split in half. It's a tiny community. There are only about 800 people in it. Half of them are living not in Shechem anymore, but they moved up the mountain when things became a little too hot to live in Shechem. And they moved up to Mount Gerizim. Half of them are Mount Gerizim, half of them in Holon. And in fact, this is a great picture. This is from a picture from the 50s, when, of course, Mount Gerizim and Shechem were in Jordanian hands, and the community was split. But as we'll see in a moment, is incumbent upon all Samaritans to come to Mount Gerizim for Passover. They give the sacrifice on Pesach, the Korban Pesach. And so they would get a humanitarian permission to come from Holon to cross the border, which nobody else was allowed to do, and to go up to Mount Gerizim. So I love the little boy with carrying his chinik, right? And they're going up to Mount Gerizim for the week of Pesach. All right, but let's go back to what they believe in and what they do. Okay, so they wear this traditional dress, which seems to be heavily influenced by the Muslims. Okay, they write in this old script, and they are a fascinating picture of what Judaism might look like if we had an oral law that was very different than the one we have today. Okay, so what do they have that's the same as us? Okay? They have the five books of Moses with minor differences, right? For example, when it says in the book of Deuteronomy that God's going to bring you to the place, Hamakom, they say the place, Mount Gerizim. They actually put it into the Torah text. Okay? But mostly it's the same book. So they have the five books of Moses. They have the book of Joshua. They do not have the other books of the Bible. Okay, they do not, of course, have the Mishnah, the Gemara, right? They don't have any of the oral law that we have. They interpret the Torah in their own way, many times in a very, very literal way. Right? So before we look at the interpretation of the Torah, it's a very easy way to remember the basic beliefs of the Samaritans. They have this kind of a, I hesitate to call it this, but a catechism, right? Five beliefs. Emanti b'cha Hashem, I believe in the one God, right? Monotheism. U'b'moshe ben Amram avdecha, and in Moses, the son of Abraham, his servant, right? They see Moses as almost like a superhuman. And he is the ultimate prophet. Uba Torah Ktosha, right? We believe in the Torah, and the written Torah, of course, is what we're talking about. Uba Har Gerizim Beit El, and the temple on Mount Gerizim. Ubiyom Nakam Vishilem, and in a judgment day. Okay, those are their basic beliefs. Monotheism, prophet Moses, the written Torah, Mount Gerizim, and that there is reward and punishment in the world, right? Now, some of their laws are like the laws that we have, and some of them are not. And it's an amazing way of understanding how do we interpret law. So for example, if you see any Samaritan building, if you go up to the community on Har Bracha, right? Right next door to Har Bracha, you will see that they do not have mezuzot, right? They do not have nice little boxes in their doorposts that have scrolls inside. They have, and the Karaites have something similar, they have a plaque above their door that has verses from the Torah. It doesn't necessarily have to be a specific verse, but it has verses from the Torah, sometimes the Ten Commandments, sometimes the Shema, right? They do not have tefillin. They don't put on phylacteries because the Torah doesn't say anything about little black boxes and straps. It says you should have this as a sign on your arm and on your heart. That's not black boxes and straps. That's Torah Shabbat Peh. That's oral law. Okay. They their sukkot are decorated very, very elaborately with fruit, including the four species, because they put the two things together, right? They say species and the sukkah, they're meant to be put together. They believe that the Torah, that the laws are incumbent upon everybody. There's no such thing as bar mitzvah, bat mitzvah. From the moment you're born, you are a Jew, or if you're a Samaritan, more accurately, you are meant to keep the Torah. And that's why in the Samaritan community, everybody fasts on Yom Kippur. The only human beings who do not fast are nursing babies, okay? After that, once you are weaned, you fast. You're old, you're sick, you're pregnant, you fast. Everybody has to fast, okay? They clearly do not use any electricity or timers or anything like that on Shabbat. Their laws of ritual, marriage and ritual purity are very different. But perhaps the most unusual thing that they do, and this is something that a lot of people go to see, is they do a sacrifice. They do a Korban Pesach, a Passover sacrifice on the mountain, okay? Because they don't believe that this is something that has passed from the world. They believe that you should continue doing the sacrifice. And so the entire community comes up for Passover. They have a special site. It's not on the very top of the mountain. It's a little bit further down. It's not the archaeological site that we're going to see in a minute. They have these huge pits. Every family comes. I mean, it really is very instructive if you're learning about Korban Pesach and the sacrifice and what was done in temple times. A lot of what they do is the same, right? Each family has an animal, and they come, and at the signal, there's a signal from the Kohen. They all slaughter their animals at the same time. They roast them in these huge pits. They eat them right at that moment with their soft matzah, with their version of what is the bitter herbs of maror. It's really a fascinating thing. The last thing we're going to take a look at is at the very top of the hill, a little bit up from the Samaritan community, is the archaeological site. Okay. Now, in the archaeological site, there is a site that is holy to the Samaritans, that they believe, and that's over here, this Givat Olam, Everlasting Hill. They believe this is where the sacrifice of Isaac happened, where God's going to descend and bring the temple, right? All these different things. But archaeology shows us that in the center, and you can see it in the photograph, right? It's really an amazing photograph. In the center, where you have this massive Byzantine hexagonal church, okay, it seems that this church is built over the remains of the Samaritan temple. Because if you look at this picture, right, you have all these, the colors are very useful. The purple is the Hellenistic period, right? So fourth, third, second century, right, before the Common Era. You have a little bit, the blue is the Persian period, the really early stuff. There's not so much. But basically what you have is you have a lot of elements that are very temple-like. You have a massive entrance with a staircase from the east with a six-chambered gate. You have all kinds of rooms around that are used for preparing sacrifices. And we're going to see you have a lot of remains of sacrifices. And according to archaeology, this area where the church was, this is where the Samaritan temple was. When was it? What exactly was there? We'll look at it in a second. A little further away from it is the site that the Samaritans believe was where their temple is, and that's where they come to on their pilgrimage. But according to archaeology, it's really this site in the middle. And not only the structure shows us that it was a temple, because it has much that is similar to the temple in Jerusalem, right? East-west orientation and all of these various elements, but it has all kinds of artifacts that also show us that this was temple-like, okay? We have inscriptions in ancient Hebrew letters, including Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei, the name of God, okay? We have a little bell. We know that the high priest is supposed to wear a robe with bells on the bottom. We have a lot of animal bones, okay? Animal bones that were discovered here, 400,000 animal bone fragments, lots and lots of pottery. Okay, all of these pieces give us a sense that this is a holy site. Perhaps one of the most intriguing things is this, which doesn't look like much, right? This kind of a snake-like thing. We know that in the temple in Jerusalem, there was a snake, the Nachash Nechoshet, the copper serpent from the time of Moses that King Hezekiah gets rid of because it becomes an object of idol worship. They had a copper snake as well. Now, when is this temple built? Can we figure that out from the sources from archaeology? So we have two different sources that tell us when it was built. The book of Nehemiah talks about how there's this conflict between the Samaritans and the Jews. And one of the Jews, right? One of the Kohanim, the high priest, his brother marries a non-Jew. And one of the challenges of Nehemiah is to get rid of intermarriage. Marries a non-Jew. And Nehemiah, of course, is very upset and he sends him away, right? And he goes to Sanballat HaChorani, the Samaritan leader, right? And that seems to be the point where they make this breakaway temple. So this is in the time of Nehemiah. We're talking about the 5th century before the Common Era. Josephus brings us a very similar story. The elders of Jerusalem being very uneasy that the brother of Yaduah, the high priest, married to a foreigner, should be a partner with him in the high priesthood. They told him to divorce his wife. So he came to his father-in-law, Sanballat, right? Same guy. And even though he loves him, he doesn't want to lose his, you know, being the priest. So Sanballat promised to preserve to him the honor of the priesthood, and he would build him a temple like that at Jerusalem upon Mount Gerizim. Now, Josephus tells this story, and he says it's happening in the time, around the time of Alexander the Great, meaning the 4th century before the Common Era. Nehemiah, 5th century before the Common Era. Who's right? They found coins up here, and the earliest coin is 480 BCE, the 5th century. So Nehemiah is right. The temple is built in the 5th century. It's a city and a temple throughout the Persian period. Alexander the Great, we know, has a conflict with the Samaritans, first with the Jews, who are the Samaritans egg Alexander the Great to destroy the temple, but instead he destroys the temple on Mount Gerizim. They rebuild it. The Hashmonaei king, Yohanan Hyrcanus, destroys it again. They become powerful again. And in Byzantine times, the Samaritans revolt against the Byzantines, and they are really They are really destroyed completely. The temple is destroyed. The church is built on top of it. And the Samaritans go into a very deep decline. But at their height in Roman times, Second Temple times, Roman times, they are a very, very formidable force. Right? And the final thing, if you go up to Mount Gerizim, one of the best places to go is the Trina factory, because Har Bracha Trina, which is owned by the Samaritans, but has the highest ultra-Orthodox kashrut certification, is the best Trina in Israel and very worth going to visit. So let's see, we got a lot of questions here. Let's see what some of our questions are. Okay. And then we'll see if anybody else has other questions. Okay, let's go back to the beginning. Okay. Right, Batya Maydad lives in Shiloh. We used to host many journalists. From here, you can see, right? That's true. You can see many, many things in Elon Moreh. A Roman amphitheater and their amazing acoustics. True, right? But the Roman amphitheaters, sometimes they did pick natural spots. Sometimes they created the acoustics themselves. Okay. Shechem is inhabited, but it's inhabited for a very, very long time. Seems to be destroyed, re-inhabited, right? And one of the suggestions is, yes, after the Dina story, it is destroyed and neglected for a few hundred years. And again, you'd have to really do much more serious archaeological excavations to be able to do that, okay? In the 70s, you could go between the two mountains, very nice, right? Why is Har Gerizim called Har Bracha? The community on top is called Har Bracha. The mountain is called Har Gerizim. The community, there's actually two communities, one next door to the other. Har Bracha, which is a Jewish community, has a yeshiva. Some people may be familiar with Rabbi Eliezer Melamed, wrote a very important work of halacha, Pnine Halacha. That's the Jewish community. Literally next door is the Samaritan community. So the mountain is Mount Gerizim. The community is Har Bracha. Yes, 600,000 men. That's an excellent question. And there are definitely different opinions about, was it everyone? Was it only some people? Were there really 600,000 in the Exodus? And that's a larger question. Right, they're divided between Har Gerizim and Har Eival, and the Kohanim are in the valley below. Oh, yes, Paula, we did go there in the summer. Rav Hillel Lieberman, thank you. I mentioned him, who was attacked and murdered in Joseph's tomb. Why does David choose Hebron and not Shechem? Okay, very simple answer. David is from the tribe of Judah. Hebron is his home base. It's much more sympathetic to him than Shechem, which is Ephraim, Menashe, nothing to do with him. Okay? The name of the man who started the breakaway and established the kingdom of Israel. Yes, it's always confusing these kings. He is Yeravam or Jeroboam. Okay, it sounds better in Hebrew. His rival, the son of King Solomon, is Rehavam. If you get confused, don't worry, most people do. Okay. Would Joshua have been standing in Nablus with the hostile Canaanite population? That's a very good question. Was there a hostile Canaanite population? Did they make a separate covenant? One of the things that's very interesting is in the whole list of conquests that Joshua does, right? We have that long list in chapter 12 of, like, I think it's 32 cities. Shechem is not one of those cities. So do they make a separate peace? Are they not built? We don't know. So that doesn't seem there is a hostile Canaanite population. Neapolis, why the Romans use a Greek name instead of a Latin one? Neapolis is not Latin. Also, I confess to ignorance of Latin versus Greek. I would have thought it's Latin. Why was it built in the valley? Okay, so why was it built in the valley? Good question, right? The valley is very fertile. There's water, there's agriculture, and presumably they used the high ground to defend because it's surrounded by these mountains. So if you could control the mountains as well, right, you can defend it. Synagogues, I'm not going to address that question because it's a long question. It's an interesting question, but it is not for this time. Tel Shiloh has water underneath, not a real tell. Okay, it is a real tell though, because it has the layers of the settlement in it. But yes, there is a spring.
No, but there's no layers of actual. You have the walls, but it's a cistern underneath. It has to do with the water storage for visitors.
Okay, but when we say tell, we just mean layers upon layers of archaeology. But yes, thank you. Good Samaritans, greetings from Manhattan. Thank you. Samaritan DNA testing. I don't know if anybody's done Samaritan DNA testing. The Samaritans, if anybody's gone to visit the Samaritans, they have heavily, what's the word? Intramarried, I think is the word I'm looking for, right? Married among themselves, and they have genetic issues because of that. So I don't know if that would really work because it would have to go many, many generations back, but I don't know if that's, I don't know if they've done that. What is their version of Maro? So their version of Maro is something called a sow thistle. It's actually something that's mentioned in the Mishnah as one of the possibilities for Maror. It's one of the plants that grow naturally in the land of Israel, and that's what they eat. Right. The mitzvah of Korban Pesach, very interesting question. Should we be doing it? Should we not? That's a more of a political question, I think, than a halachic question. Why didn't they rebuild their temple? I don't think they had the power to rebuild their temple. The Byzantines really destroy them. There's a terrible, terrible massacre, and they just never come back to their power again. But you are correct that they are never exiled. And one of the things that the Samaritans are very proud of when you go to visit them and to talk to them is they say, we have never left the land of Israel. All right, they have never left the land of Israel. All right, I'm not going to get into the Korban Pesach. Thank you for the compliment. Link to the recording on the website. Yes. And any other questions? What happened to the Byzantine church built over the Samaritan temple? Well, you can still see it. The remains are still there. It was not destroyed. Presumably, when the Muslims conquer, the church becomes less important, but you definitely have churches as well as Samaritan synagogues, by the way, all over the area of Samaria, of Shomron. And if you want to see that next time you come to Israel, there's a great museum called the Good Samaritan Museum on the outskirts of Maale Adumim in the Judean desert. And you can see a lot of these Jewish synagogues, Samaritan synagogues, and Christian churches. Okay. Thank you, everybody. It was a pleasure. And I will see you all next week. Next week, we are leaving the mountains and we are going to the coast. And thank you, Orly, for stepping in for Rabbi Kelman.